Dan Grantham,
Yeah, I got you.
would you mind leading us in a word of prayer before we start?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, we'll go ahead and do that and we'll dive right in.
All right, let's all pray. Our Holy Father, it's a blessing to come before you and to be able to study your word together and to learn from you, to learn from your servant Paul and from what he has exemplified for us and written to these Corinthians. We're thankful for this class that we've been able to build each other up through, for David and Marty and for the work they've put into this. We pray that with all of this that we would take lessons and be lights in this world, serve you better, and continue to look forward to your word every day and put our lives into that. We thank you for this evening. Be with us through this study for us to learn as much as we can. Through your son we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. Very good. All right. Well, tonight we are in lesson. Where are we? Yes, lesson 19, almost into the 20s. So we're getting close to the midpoint here of the second half. It's the third class of period that we're spending on this section of the text, chapters 8, 9, and 10 from 1 Corinthians. So this is my last shot to get whatever I want to say about these chapters in, and then we're going to have to move on to something else. It is a Wednesday night, though, so if I follow Marty's example, I could keep you here as long as I need to to get through with everything. But we'll try to keep it reasonably short, I guess. And then Marty will tell us at the end. It's like waiting for that extra movie scene at the end of the credits, right? You got to wait all the way to the end to hear what Marty's going to tell you for next time for Sunday. But by now, I hope we're supposed to be in chapter 10. We're actually going to pick up the last few verses of chapter 9. But I hope by now that we've, first couple slides here, we've seen all this before. We've walked through in our first class period all three of these chapters, trying to get an overview of what everything is being discussed here, made a little outline of it. And, of course, the main issue that runs through all of these chapters has to do with eating meats that have been sacrificed to idols. And we said the Corinthian context, that's really, let me get my little pin here, right? Is really something that seems to be an issue among the Gentile believers that had come out of pagan idolatry. They probably grew up in this culture where everybody went to the temple all the time for various sacrifices, and they worshiped all these different idols, thinking there's nothing wrong with that. But then once they came to know the truth about God, once they came to accept Jesus through the gospel, they came to realize that this idolatry, we can't have anything to do with that. And so for them, as Paul described in chapter 8, having been accustomed to the idol by now, it would violate their conscience. They would feel guilty if they were to consume any of this meat that had been part of an idol sacrifice. And that might extend even to the point that they would think that the mere process of an animal being slaughtered as part of a sacrificial rite to some idol somehow intrinsically changes the nature of that meat, so that anyone that eats it at any point, at any time, in any context, anywhere after that, they're somehow connected to that idol, and they don't want to do that. And to some extent, that may be a safe way to go. But as Paul says in chapter 8, if you have a certain amount of knowledge, once you know that there's really no such thing as an idol and all things are clean, the meat really isn't altered or changed fundamentally from the sacrificial process. You can eat some of that meat under the right conditions and not be an offense to the Lord, right? But there are other considerations that we have to make, and that's what these chapters are about. So that's what we're dealing with, this issue of folks that had grown up or come out of a particular religious culture, certain belief system, having come to understand what's sinful about that belief system, and they're now trying to follow the truth. But they're leftovers, literally, of that old system that still permeates the culture around them. How do they deal with those remnants? How do they deal with the meat throughout their food supply that's been sacrificed to idols? And then the other dimension to this that we're going to be looking at in more detail in the chapters, the verses tonight, there's still a real evil there, right? Idolatry is just flat out wrong. And it seems that some of the Corinthians here had been puffed up enough with their knowledge that they felt that they could maybe even go into the idol's temple under certain circumstances to eat some of this meat. Excuse me. And that not only was wrong, I think we'll see, but could lead to worse things that they needed to be very careful about. So a couple things going on here. And we try to highlight, so maybe a little different from some other other food-related issues of conscience, right? Can I eat meat at all or not? I grew up as a Jew, and you can't eat pork at all. Not pork that's been sacrificed or processed in a certain way. It's just flat out, I can't do it. That's an issue of conscience. And that doesn't carry with it the same sort of real evil that you have to avoid while you're figuring out whether or not you can still be able to eat that meat under the new covenant. So that's what makes this a little bit different. I think we get through this as well. We're going to see in our verses tonight, flee idolatry, chapter 10, verse 14. Have nothing to do with it. Run away from it. Just like flee immorality back in chapter 6, I think it was, right? It's a very stark language. Have nothing to do with it. There might be, and we're still not sure, I'm not really convinced one way or the other, whether Paul is advocating in chapter 8 that, yeah, you could go to an idol's temple under certain circumstances with your knowledge and eat the meat there without actually worshiping the idol, and that's okay, only except for the possible influence it has on other people who might have a weaker conscience. You could make the argument that you really shouldn't be in that idol's temple at all. And that's why it's in yellow here. At a minimum, you need to take care. You have to be very wary of the dangers of doing that. Not just
he almost comes back to that in chapter 10 and says, if you think you stand, take heed. Almost like the example of the Israelites who had a lot of things going for them, but
yes,
just the associations around them were too much for them.
And that's sort of the theme of this knowledge. The knowledge puffs you up. The knowledge gives you a false sense of confidence, the false sense of what kind of situations you can not be tempted by, and can deceive you into thinking that you're stronger than you are, right? Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take it. You might not actually be standing as upright as you think you are. You might have a warped sense of your immunity to these outside influences. So that was some of the danger with this knowledge here. So they need to take care for themselves. And, of course, in chapter 8, the greater emphasis is take care of what your weaker brethren might be influenced by your action. Then these latter two scenarios, meat that's sold in the market very often came from the idol temples after the sacrifices. And then what do you do? You're just eating in someone's home and find out that some of the meat had been part of an idol sacrifice. What do you do? So these are some practical questions. The green zone here, there are scenarios where eating that meat is fine, but there are other scenarios where you need to take other factors into consideration. And hopefully we'll get to that before we run out of time tonight. So the overview quickly, the first chapter 8 introduces the topic, and it does introduce it. It seems to follow the demarcation lines that we've established. Paul here answering some of their questions from earlier correspondence. Verse 1, now concerning the things sacrificed to idols. They had asked questions about various marriage relationships in chapter 7. Chapter 8 begins the discussion. Chapter 11, verse 2. He shifts gears again, chapter 12, now concerning things, spiritual gifts. So there's some topics here he's walking through. He introduces this in chapter 8, talks about the difference between knowledge, which puffs up and gets you into trouble in this context, versus love, which seeks the benefit of others first. And then the issue of liberty and conscience. You have this knowledge, it gives you a certain liberty. If you exercise it unconditionally, you run the risk of causing a brother to act against his conscience, and that's a harmful thing that he describes. And so the principle that Paul establishes at the end of that verse or chapter is, if meat is going to cause my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat again. That's how strongly he takes it. He will go to whatever lengths he can to avoid causing a brother with a weaker conscience from sinning against his conscience and therefore sinning against Christ. So that's the principle. And then it seems like he veers off into a whole nother topic. And there are some commentators that I guess suggest that chapter 9 may be like almost a different epistle or a different letter or a different sermon outline or something that he just throws in here. But when you sandwich it with chapter 10 and chapter 8, I think it the flow of thought is what we've been describing here. He spends a lot of time establishing that he has a right to be paid as an apostle and some other things, but he's never really used that right with the Corinthians. He has voluntarily chosen not to take any money from them for their benefit, that he might not be a hindrance to the gospel, did not want money issues to trip them up in any way. I mean, they had all sorts of other problems, as we see in the church here, and he didn't want to complicate that by doing that. So he's using himself and his own actions as illustration of this principle from chapter 8 of yielding your rights for the benefit of someone else. That's how I've treated you, Corinthians. That's how you came to be part of Christ, was because of my willingness, in part, to relinquish my own rights. Then he expands that toward the end of this section, the famous verse, I will do all things, I've become all things to all men that I might by all means save some. He's so fervent in his desire to get the message to as many people as he can that he's willing to adapt himself and give up whatever rights and make whatever personal sacrifices he needs to further the gospel message. So that's what we got last time. Tonight, I move this, I can see the clock, so I can see how much time we have left. All right, we're still reviewing. This is what we're getting into tonight. Chapter 20, verse 24, chapter 9. We shift gears a little bit again. Paul's been talking about himself, about the rights he has, and how he's sacrificed those for others. Now he starts talking about how, in his own personal walk, he disciplines himself, some things that he denies to himself, things that he's concerned about in his own personal life to ensure that he does not end up, as he says here, disqualified from the race and does not win the prize, does not become a partaker of the gospel. We'll see that here in a minute. Then having used himself, you know, personally as an example of someone who still, despite all that he's done, is concerned about the risk of failure, the risk of falling, the risk of disqualifying himself. He points back to the Israelites and talks about all the advantages that it had and all the many different ways, or some of the many different ways, that they fell short and the consequences of all that. And then draws this lesson we've already mentioned about taking heed lest you fall as a warning to them. And then he hits them hard with flee from idolatry. There's the take-home message there, the truth about idolatry. Let's talk about it. You can't be involved in that. You can't partake of the table of demons and the table of the Lord. It just is completely incompatible behavior, and makes his argument about that. He hopes, I think, by the time he gets there, it's almost self-evident what it is he has to say about idolatry, that they could agree with the claims that he's making. Then he wraps up the section by reiterating this need to edify others as being a guiding principle in how we choose to conduct ourselves. Some very practical things about dealing with the meat issue, and then some summary principles that kind of wrap this all up. Okay. Having walked through that again, let's pick up here in the middle of chapter 9. We made references, I think, in the lesson sheet to the Isthmian Games. Anyone care to summarize for us, tell us a little bit what the Isthmian Games were all about, or just what they were.
Like the Olympics, one of the three or so, or I can't remember how many there were, of which the Olympics was one, but
right,
athletic competitions where people would come from various parts and represent their city or whatever.
Yeah.
Competitions.
It was part of, you know, the ancient Olympics. We have the modern Olympic Games. It was in Atlanta a couple decades ago, right? This is the forerunner of that, the original Olympic Games. One of the sites that they alternated every four years, or every, they had 3 years of competition and an off year. But at least one of the sites where these types of games were hosted was at Corinth. Corinth was a host for one of these athletic events. And running certainly was part of it. Read somewhere that boxing probably was a sport that was part of the competition here. So
probably not breakdancing, I don't guess.
Yeah, that's true. That's
is the new sport that's coming here, I guess.
Is that the French, I think, that we're introducing that? Yes, right. They come and go, but boxing and running, those are one of the old ones that have been around for a long time. Why would Paul mention sporting events in this context? What is he trying to do? Have you ever known a gospel preacher to try to make an illustration, you know, from day-to-day life to try to highlight a point that he's trying to make? Even in our class, I can't remember if we did this. I remember Grant, in some of his original material, used a baseball scorecard from the Braves game last fall where they broke the record, or the 29 home runs in the single game or whatever it was. And he had the scorecard there. And I forget what point he was trying to illustrate, something about, looking at the context to understand what this was. But us Atlanta Braves fans could look at that and know, yep, I know what he's talking about there. I remember that game. Who could forget it? So in some ways, that's what he's doing here by talking about running and boxing and the games and the wreath that is the prize, the self-control and the discipline that you have to exercise as part of an athletic endeavor. These would be things they would be familiar with as Corinthians. They would probably take some sort of pride in this. This is not some abstract, the Olympics. Oh, yeah, I know about the Olympics. They do that far away and some far away distant places. Something that took place in town, was part of their civic heritage, part of their culture, and they would be very familiar with it.
So and David.
Yes, ma'am.
In verse 26, he's just really bringing home, comparing our race to the race, but that is done with a purpose. He's just not out there being aimless.
Exactly. If you're serious about winning, right, if you're in a competition and you want to get that prize, you want to be the first across the finish line, you want to be the one that TKOs your opponent, whatever it may be, you do so with purpose. You don't run without aim. You're not just wandering about the track in no particular direction. You're trying to get as quickly as you can to the finish line in a straight line. With purpose. If you're boxing, you're not shadow boxing. You're not just beating the air. You're trying to land blows upon your opponent in order to advance your cause. So when we're running in a race, and of course, what's the parallel to Paul's life and really our lives as Christians as well? This race we're trying to run, what is the prize for that?
Eternal life.
Yeah, ultimately, eternal life, this imperishable wreath, right? It's a spiritual thing. And it's a race. It's a competition. One thing where it falls a little bit short, he talks about only one receives the prize. That means there's only one Christian that's ever going to make it to heaven. First one there, first one to the pearly gates gets in. I don't think that's what he's trying to say, right? It's more in a real race. There is only one prize winner, so if you want to compete, you've got to really apply yourself and be disciplined to run in such a way that you may be that winner. In the Christian life, we're running, but we can't be slack about it. We can't be running aimlessly. We can't be, if we're trying to run to the finish line, we can't be carrying excess baggage. The Hebrew writer talks about laying aside every encumbrance, so let's run with endurance, the race that is set before. You don't pack on extra weight in your race to reach the finish line. You do the things that you have to do to make sure that you're going to be the first one across. So you run with purpose. You run with awareness that you might lose. That may be part of it too, right? Just because you're doing well in the race, can you give up midway through, slow down, take your eye off the prize and not keep your mind focused on what you're trying to achieve? Many factors come into play, and when it comes into trying to win a competition like this, does
can
it
I
take preparation,
David?
Yes, you may.
And maybe Marty might want to jump in. I'm not sure, but in verse 27, just to kind of go along with what you're saying, I did have a question about the body and make it my slave. Now, what term would you say that slave was? It made me think about the video that we watched and how they didn't want to use the word slave because it had a negative connotation. So how would you do that, slave?
Well, what I have on the slides is New American Standard, not the ESV. I think the video was talking about the ESV team trying to decide what term to use there. And I'll be honest, I haven't looked up exactly which Greek word this, which bond servant type.
I'm pretty sure it's doulos. Tell me the verse again. I've got the interlinear up.
It's verse 27.
10. I'm sorry, 9.
Yeah, chapter 9, verse 27. Yeah. Well, while Marty looks that up, when you couple that with this idea of disciplining my body and this idea of exercising self-control, what's the idea behind self-control in an athletic competition? Can you eat whatever you want, whenever you want? Can you sleep all the time? Can you slack off doing your training runs? You have to prepare yourself for this.
Everything you do has purpose.
Absolutely. And think about, even in modern times, true Olympic athletes and the extreme lengths that they'll go to in their training in order to perfect their skills, in order to increase their endurance and stamina and strength to accomplish whatever it is that they need to accomplish in their sport. There's a sense of self-denial in some ways. You can't be eating Krispy Kremes and milkshakes all the time if you're going to be an elite athlete. And that means you have to – and is that easy to do? What often – is your opponent if you are striving to control yourself for an athletic competition?
The desire to do something different.
Yeah. And where do those desires come from?
Within.
From within, from my flesh, from my body, right? My body is tired, but I've got to keep going. My body is hungry. I want to eat that donut, but yeah, I know that I can't do that if I'm going to achieve my goal. So disciplining my body, this idea of making it my slave, making it my servant, it's not going to control me. I'm going to control it. I'm the one in charge. And Paul is saying he has to continue, and he pictures it in this way of this boxing. It's like my opponent, it seems to be, is my own body. I'm boxing against my own body. There's a struggle that I have between me and my flesh, me and my body. And it wants me to do certain things and I want to do something else. And he's determined here that he's going to prevail in that struggle, and exercise his self-control and, put his own body and bodily desires, in service to him and not the other way around. The point of all that being, that's what you got to do if you're going to win the prize, if you're going to win the race.
Dave, I'll answer Teresa's question.
Okay, yes.
The word is doulagogio, which is a compound of doula, which is our word for slave, not the word for bind or handcuff. You know, we looked at those two different words that showed up in chapter 7. But the other part of the compound is the Greek word for drive or lead.
Okay.
Bring. So it literally, the word really means drive into slavery or lead into slavery or bring into slavery. So it's kind of an intensification of the word to enslave.
So is it this make it my slave? Is that the idea of?
Yeah, I think so. Or he says to bring or carry or lead away. That's the other part of the compound word. So.
Okay.
The idea is that with some effort and initiative and determination,
right,
you bring it into service so that it's in totally in your control and under your service and accomplishes the will, your will, as opposed to something else.
Kind of you might think in terms of like taming a wild animal or something.
Exactly.
Right. That's out of control, and then you do what it takes to discipline and quote unquote enslave it, put it under your control. So that this raging beast is something now that you have control over. In this case, it's our own body, our own desires, our own flesh that may run amok if left without any self-control. You know, think of the other extreme, someone that just has no self-control at all and just gives into whatever physical desire they have all the time. That's out of control. So you're trying to bring that sort of situation under your control through this discipline. Wayne, did you have something else?
A comment, not on this, but on the last word in that passage.
Disqualified.
Disqualified. It's I don't know what the Greek word is.
Marty can tell us. He's got it right up there.
But it's interesting that as he kind of talks about the spiritual aspect of this race, There are really only two options. You get disqualified, or you get the prize, or you, you make it to the end. So he said, after I have preached to others, the others, I am assuming the point is that they will get to the prize. I might be disqualified. So in this race, several people can get the prize. But the other option is disqualification.
Right. I think that's part of it. And in the context, especially the verses, I don't have it in this deck, but verse 23, you know, I do all things for the sake of the gospel that I may become a fellow partaker of it, that I will not be disqualified after being preaching to everyone else. He's been talking about all these things to all men, and all the things that he's done in service of the Lord in preaching the gospel to get as many people saved as he can. But he's still aware that if he doesn't control his body and discipline himself and have this self-control, his own self, he still has a risk of being disqualified. And that's really the message that he's leading into, the kind of culminating in verse 13 here. No matter how strong you are, how great a servant of the Lord you've been, how many people you've brought to the Lord, or what you might be able to point to in your own life is, look at all the great things I've done. Is any of that a guarantee that we won't, through our own failures, disqualify ourselves later on? Not. You know, even the Apostle Paul has to, as he illustrates here, exercise this sort of discipline. For the Corinthians to be hearing this, what impression might this have on them? Paul the Apostle, worried about his own body.
Thought that even Paul, this person that they would look up to, that they said, I am a Paul, it could be disqualified as well.
Yeah. If Paul's concerned about finishing the race, winning the race, getting to the finish line, then shouldn't we be even more so? I wouldn't consider myself, you know, the kind of strong Christian that Paul is. I don't have the kind of talents and abilities and knowledge that he has. And if he's concerned about this, then maybe I ought to think twice about my own strength, my own imperviousness to these fleshly desires. So if this personal example, so he starts small, starts just with myself, and starts with an example they can relate to from their culture, the Isthmian Games. They would understand the illustration he's making here. He shifts gears now in chapter 10. It flows right into the next chapter about the history of the children of Israel, which, you know, in our introduction, we pointed out how it seems like this whole issue of meat and idols and idolatry, these were things that the Gentile Christians would have to grapple with. The Jews would not be tempted to go to the idols temple. The Jews would not have the same kinds of, there were Jewish Christians as part of the group here, but this seems to be targeted for the Gentiles. And yet, in the midst of this, maybe the crowning argument of this whole, you know, the big finish in his reasoning here is all from the Old Testament. It's all from Jewish history, which almost sort of implies to me, in all the many, many months that Paul spent in Corinth and was teaching them every day, I think he went back to the Old Testament and taught them a few things about what happened in the Jewish history.
Can I make a comment, David?
Yes, sir.
Sorry to cut you, but it just occurred to me, you know, you talked about, you know, trying to weave these things together. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out, you know, why would Paul make this statement here at the end of chapter 9? I'm wondering if the thread is, you know, he talks about this liberty or this right that he has that he's not using. He goes back and talks about how the Corinthians should behave to one another. If a, you know, a weaker brother, this is in chapter 8, if a weaker brother has a problem, the liberty that you have, you should be willing to forego. And so that sounds very much like what he's saying here in terms of bringing his body under control at the end of chapter 9. Hey, self-control applies to, hey, doing it for myself, doing it for the benefit of my brethren. If I have a liberty, you know, Paul's liberty that he talks about in chapter 9, the right that he has to receive wages from them, all of those things, it seems kind of, you can weave a thread to kind of make sense of why he's talking about this at the end of the chapter. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but I just thought about that. Just thought I'd mention that.
Good. So we've been trying to, at least I've been trying to get that across. So if you're starting to think that, then maybe I'm starting to strike a chord. I don't know. Yes, I think there are two basic threads that Paul uses here. He starts with think about other people, right? You know, you and I, we know there's no such thing as idle, but you know, not everyone thinks that way. There are these other folks that have these other thoughts, and we need to consider how this might affect them. And at first, you know, Corinthians might wonder, I never really thought about it that way, Paul, and might have some resistance to say, well, that's a really difficult thing to ask us to do. So he points to his own life and shows all the very difficult things that he's done in giving up his rights for others. But the second thread, besides think of the impact this will have on your Christian brothers who have weaker consciences, is let's think really carefully about your own personal salvation. Think about your own strength. I think he's sort of gently trying to get them to realize, yeah, you've got some knowledge, and I got to admit, things you're citing here are true. There is no God but one. There is no such thing as an idol. There's nothing to an idol. But you're running in the wrong direction with that. You're taking that a little too far, and you're putting yourself at risk by thinking this way and convincing yourself you can participate in certain things without recognizing the dangers that are there. And so by starting with himself as an example, Paul is very concerned about his own ability to win the race. And so Paul has got to buffet my body, make it my slave. The self-discipline process is something he has to do himself so that he won't be disqualified. If Paul's got to do that, then you Corinthians probably need to be doing that as well. Which I think, and we're going to look at the Israelites now. And what I hope we'll see is that they face a lot of the things that he cites here in chapter 10 are the same kinds of problems that the Corinthians are dealing with right now, whether they realize it or not. The dangers are still, the temptations were there, the dangers were there, the types of sins that they might fall into are the same, and the consequences ultimately are going to be the same. So with that, well, before we get to that, I got a chart here on the next slide. Let's quickly look at the advantages, right? That's part of this too. You know, Paul, great apostle, still concerned about self-discipline. The Israelites had all these advantages going for them. You'd think it all these things in this first few verses, if we had experienced all those things, how could we possibly stray from following the Lord, right? Our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea. Do you think being part of that multitude that walked across the Red Sea on dry water with the wind holding up the water on either side and the Egyptian army coming after you, and would that make an impression on you? Seeing the power of God and sort of firsthand experiencing that? Seeing the pillar of cloud and pillar of fire that would lead the camp as they went through the wilderness? A miraculous manifestation of the presence of God? Wouldn't that bolster your faith? Wouldn't that make you want to trust in the Lord no matter what? All were baptized into several things. Moses, the cloud, the sea. We don't have time to go much into what this baptism might be a reference to, but it seems to be that they're somehow united with, right? We're baptized into Christ. We're baptized into his death, burial, resurrection. Baptized into Moses. Was Moses a well-regarded leader among the Jews? Excuse me. Not at the time necessarily by some of the people, as we're about to see, but historically speaking, yeah, he was the giver of the law, and he was the one that led them out of Egypt. You know, he was this great spiritual leader, and all these Israelites were right there at his feet for him personally, Moses, to teach them and lead them and direct them. They ate and drank manna and water from different places, and he calls it here spiritual food and water. And then there's this rock, which we'll talk about in a second. Is that Clayton? Did I hear someone try to get a word in? Maybe no, that was...
It was not me. I didn't hear it. It wasn't me.
Okay. That was my imagination. I'm hallucinating that people are making comments. I'm sorry. The idea, part of the idea of this rock, do you remember any stories back in the time of the wilderness wandering that had anything to do with a rock? What did Moses do a time or two with a rock?
They drank from the spiritual rock.
Okay, and this passage is talking about a spiritual rock. And they drank from it. What did they do physically with the rock in a couple of places?
They drank water.
Yeah, that was sort of the source where the water was. Remember, Moses struck the rock with the rod, and that's when he got into trouble. You know, trying to talk about that story, but that was one of the water incidents where they were asking for water, and Moses said, "Shall we have to give you water?" And it was a rock that from the water came. There, from what I've read, there was some sort of legend among the rabbis, not in the biblical text, but there was a rock incident, I think, as they left Egypt, and then there was another rock incident as they were getting close to the Promised Land. There were these two rocks, and they had this idea that there was an actual rock that followed behind them. You know, the cloud and the pillar that went before them, and there might have been a rock that was following behind them. And some are speculating this may be what Paul's referring to, the rock that followed them. I don't know. But by mentioning Christ and the spiritual dimension to this, all these things that the Israel, all the benefits that the Israelites had in some way involved the Lord's presence, the Lord's involvement. Not sure to go so far as to say a pre-incarnate manifestation of Christ, but they had similar spiritual benefits going for them even during that time that they can relate to as, first century Christians at least. They sort of had the same things going for them as we have going for us. So when you think about all of that, right, you might walk away and say, well, those people had so much going for them. They had to be nothing but stellar servants of the Lord. But what's the reality that we get to in verse 5?
The Lord wasn't pleased with most of them.
Yeah. In fact, that whole generation, did any of them make it to the Promised Land?
No.
Except for Joshua and Caleb, I guess. And not even Moses himself got to inherit the prize that they originally set out for them. So they failed over and over and over again. And he says here in verse 6, and he'll say again in verse 11, they happened as examples for us. There are things we can learn about their experience that apply to you Corinthians that are grappling with this meat sacrifice to idol issue. So let's quickly walk through this. I hope you had some time to look at some of these stories. Paul, it's very clear for most of these. The first one, there may be more than one possibility that fits this. Some of these, just based on the number of victims, you can tie pretty closely to a specific incident that's recorded for us in the Old Testament. But what was the first sin here in verse 6? A story perhaps from Numbers chapter 11.
That they craved evil things.
They craved evil things. You remember what the evil thing was they craved in chapter 11? You want to look that up? What's that?
Food.
Yeah.
Leeks. Food they used to enjoy.
Yeah. I always imagine leeks. I'm not a big fan of leeks, but they were just going on about, they had memories of the food they had before they left, before Moses dragged them out here in the middle of nowhere. They had tasty food, spicy food, and they really liked it. And had God provided them sustenance? Yes, he'd given them the manna, but they didn't seem too impressed with the manna that they had. They were longing for the sensory pleasures that they had back before. Well, in this particular case, what did the Lord do for them? What was the consequence of this crying out and whining about their food and wanting something more?
God wanted to destroy them. I think ultimately about 3,000 were killed.
There was a, if you read the rest of chapter 11, again, there are many episodes you could look at, but this was the time where, okay, you want some meat? I will give you some meat. You will get so much meat, you will be sick of meat. And by the next day, remember the quail came, and it was, I forget how many feet high and how many feet in each direction, and there was just so much of it that they eventually just filled their nostrils and they couldn't stand it. And even at the end of the chapter, as they began to sink their teeth into it, to finally get that tasty meat they wanted to eat, we don't know many of the details, but he says a very severe plague came upon the Lord. It enraged the Lord, and he sent this plague upon them. So We don't have a death toll in that chapter in particular.
Sorry, but I was looking ahead accidentally.
That's okay. That's all right. 3,000 would be a good guess, but definitely a case where they're craving something that they really, well, you know, was there anything intrinsically wrong with leeks and whatever other tasty food? Was it unclean? Was it, what was wrong with it?
The complaining and the grumbling.
The complaining of the
God. Like, but yeah. In store for them was a promised land. So they were looking back and said, and blaming him, like, you took us out of Egypt and we had better food.
Yes, here he's delivered them out of slavery, and yet they're complaining about what they have to eat. They should be grateful for the food that they have and the promises that are yet to come, and yet their minds are focused back on what they had before. Now, could the Corinthians be doing that to some extent with this whole meat sacrifice to idol business? You know, if the best food in town was what they sliced up every week down at the Temple of Aphrodite or whatever, that's the only place you could really get a good steak, you know, or whatever it was. And they're having to cut themselves off from that because they're not participating in that anymore. Could there be some experiences and some pleasures and that may not intrinsically be wrong, but that they would express dissatisfaction for not being able to participate in? Could that be a dimension of what's going on here? I think that may, I mean, Paul's warning them about this kind of thing, so I'm pretty sure this was part of their thinking. They were longing for some things they used to be able to do, but they're not doing it anymore, and they're wanting to go back. Chapter 32, this is the famous story, right? Don't be idolaters like they were. This is the golden calf story, which took place right at the base of Mount Sinai while Moses is up receiving the law from the Lord. What were some of the reasons why they put this golden calf idea together from that story?
They lost sight of the Lord.
Okay. As for this Moses, we don't know what's happened to him. Now, there's almost a bit of that knowledge coming in. Right, in the Corinthians, and we know there's nothing really involved with an idol. We can go in there and eat the meat there and not be affected by any of the other shenanigans going on in there. You know, we don't know what's happened to this Moses. All we know, he's not here. He's been gone for a month or more, and you know, what's become of him? We don't know. We've got to come up with some sort of plan. We need someone to lead us.
I noted on that one peer pressure, too, man. Maybe there's a element of peer pressure in this.
Yeah, definitely. It was a group think, to be sure. And certainly for Aaron's role, he certainly felt very pressured by the people. The people wanted him to do this. Out popped this calf. I had nothing to do with it. Just the people that wanted to come along with. The whole idea of making an idol out of gold, very likely something that they learned from the culture they came from, Egyptian idolatry. That was something they did. Did they, in their own minds, maybe think that this golden calf was a complete rejection of the Jehovah God that had brought them out of Egypt? I don't think so, because what did they say? But behold, Israel, your God who led you out of the land of Egypt. So they attributed to this idol the things that Jehovah God had done for them. So in their minds, yeah, the golden calf is just a symbol. We're still worshiping the true God. So you know, maybe they had done some mental gymnastics to do that. But the passage he highlights here, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. It was more the sensual pleasures that came with the worship they invented. That was probably the big attraction for doing this. Well, this didn't work out well. They ground up the idol and put it in the water and made them drink it. And then the Levites came to Moses' side and they slew 3,000 men on that day as part of the punishment for their idolatry. And obviously, for the Corinthians thinking about going back to idolatry, even just partially, they should be aware of this danger. Nor let us act immorally. This is Numbers 25, which is another idolatry scenario, but what did it seem it really started with? The story of Balaam and the Moabites and Baal worship, Baal of Peor. Started with the women, didn't it? The daughters of Moab seem to have played a role in this. So a lot of times the idolatry leads to immorality because a lot of the pagan worship involved idolaters, the temple prostitutes and so forth. This may almost seem to have started the other way around, right? The women enticed the men first, and from there they began to worship the idols that were part of their culture there. But the immorality was, is what Paul focuses here. Don't act that way. There were 23,000 killed in one day, according to Paul. Numbers tells us there were an extra 1,000, I guess, that they cleaned up later. But it was a pretty vile plague that came upon the people because of their immorality. Yes.
It kind of made me think about Solomon being the wisest man, mm-hmm. but he wasn't very wise when it came to women. But it doesn't really, or at least I never really paid attention to it, that how many men and women may have died because of his choice of marrying all these different types of women that eventually led him away. Like on here it says like 23,000 and then maybe 3,000, but I don't think it, or at least I never paid attention to how many people died because of the choices that Solomon made.
Yeah, sin can have consequences, and the ones that Paul highlights here definitely have some pretty serious consequences. The story in Numbers 21 where they try the Lord. Remember what was going on there? This was toward the end of their wanderings as they're starting to approach the promised land to enter it. They became impatient, it said, with the journey. They had to go around, maybe take a detour, a longer route than they originally planned. And that made them impatient. And again, complaints about there's nothing. I found it funny. There's no food and there's no water and we hate this food. So they had food. They just didn't like it. We hate this miserable food, it says here. And again, cries of why have you brought us out here to die in the wilderness? So they're definitely losing trust in the Lord. And Paul describes it as trying the Lord, testing him with their complaints and their constant disobedience and demands for things. And this was the fiery serpent story. Where the fiery serpents came, and we don't have a body count here as well, but a number of them died, and it changed their tune pretty quickly in that case. And then the last story, and there are a couple places where this happens, nor grumbling, murmuring, I think is another word that is often used, as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. This case in Numbers 16, this was after Korah's rebellion. I mean, Korah's rebellion was bad enough. A bunch of folks said, hey, you're not the only ones that can lead us, Moses and Aaron. We're going to be the leaders. We're going to take us back to Egypt, perhaps, instead of following you. And after they were swallowed up by the earth, the next day, some of the people behind said, you have caused the death of the Lord's people. They're grumbling to Moses and Aaron over the punishment, the consequences of the rebellion of Korah and his folks. And so that grumbling against Moses and Aaron resulted in yet another plague that Moses and Aaron had to shut down, but not before 14,700 more Israelites were slain by that. So the Corinthians, in thinking about idols and eating meat and all that, are any of these temptations, are these sins possible temptations that they could be encountering? We already talked about the evil things that they seem to be craving. Certainly if they're thinking they can go to an idol's temple, that's something they should have nothing to do with, and yet they seem interested in. Most of the pagan worship had some degree of immorality associated with it, so they're opening themselves up to that temptation as well. And then trying the Lord and grumbling, which both indicate a certain amount of ingratitude and impatience and in some cases, wanting to go back. That was one thread I saw in almost all these cases, was like, why are we here? This isn't working out well. We want to go back, seemed to be a common thread. And convincing yourself that you can go back to an idol's temple after coming out of that sort of religion is something that the Corinthians seem to be doing. Someone have a comment?
David, I was just wondering about, I've been memorizing or reading Philippians, and where it says, do not grumble or complain, mm-hmm. so that we can be pure and blameless. And like, is there a difference? I guess in here it's all about attitude and and the desires of what the Israelites in this case wanted. Like, can we offer our request to God? Like, can we complain or grumble? Like, sometimes I feel like when I pray, like I have something, like, not against God, but like, this is what's going on, Lord, with my life. We can, mm-hmm. is there, is there something wrong with about doing that? Like, I don't know, because I was like, don't complain, Den, don't grumble, because you want to be pure and blameless. But sometimes I just want to talk to God about what's going on, and I just want to make sure I'm not doing, you know.
Yes, I hear what you're saying. I don't think the lesson from here is we shouldn't take our concerns, our cares, cast your cares upon the Lord. We're told to do in the New Testament. Certainly bringing our troubles, expressing the problems we're dealing with before the Lord, that's certainly something he wants to help us with, and he wants us to express that.
King David.
Yes.
Not you, David, the other David. He certainly had, there's lots of examples of him praying those sorts of prayers, Den, so I don't think that's wrong at all. We've got a lot of examples, just like David Williams just said, but all through Psalms, tons of that.
Yes. So that doesn't cross the threshold as being sinful. If you come to the Lord frustrated with what's going on in your life and asking him for help or asking him for guidance, asking him for patience, that's not testing the Lord. That's not trying the Lord in the way that these people had been doing. Or grumbling about, this grumble in particular is questioning the judgment of God in a very particular way. And that's not the kind of, not quite the same thing as what you're describing.
Yeah, and 9 and 10 there were done very publicly and very outwardly too. That's yes. Another big difference.
Yes, very much so.
And directed toward the Lord's leaders. I think that's a key thing in 9 and 10, and that is it was actually against Moses, who represented Jehovah before them.
Right.
That seemed like almost the main thing about it.
Yeah, and you see that connection there. They never said a word out loud about God. It was Moses and Aaron, you've done this. And the Lord immediately interpreted that as an affront to his authority and his right to do what he's done there.
And I wonder, I actually thought about that, in the example of Paul using his liberty, I thought about that some since your lesson last Sunday. There's more to that example because, yes, he did not use his liberty as he could have, but for whose benefit? Who benefited from his sacrifice? Well, they did. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so if you think about these excursions, they often have a secondary power to them. And in this case, I wonder if there's somebody who was God's representative that they might be in danger of rejecting or complaining against. I wonder if there's something to that, you know.
Well, we've already hinted at, right? How they questioned Paul's apostleship, questioned his authority. And yes, I was going to make the point a little later. That this is something that I think that they're potentially guilty of themselves. So that may be another dimension that he's bringing to their minds. Don't grumble against the Lord's authority, against the Lord's appointed representative. Because that's dangerous. So to try to wrap up, I know I've gone over. I'm going to try to finish very quickly the rest of the chapter here. We won't go into as much detail, but he makes the point that these things, all these things we just talked about, happened to them as an example, number one, and they were written for our instruction. Do you ever find yourself thinking, boy, that God in the Old Testament, he had a hair trigger temper, and boy, he would just lash out at people and just way overkill. I am so thankful we live in this loving God that we live under now, right? Ever think that way or hear people think that way? Or,
no, I've never thought that way ever.
Never, okay. Well, you're not very creative then. Right? the contrast is stark, isn't it? But Paul says it happened to them, not the things they did, maybe some of it, but the consequences, perhaps, were he's making an example out of these people. We use that term in our own lives, right? Parents or you know, a teacher, student incurs some infraction, and there's some very visible, very public punishment that he doles out. For what purpose? To make an example out of that person, to teach everyone else, don't make the same mistake or else you'll see what happens to you. So I think that's part of what Paul's suggesting here is that these very severe consequences that took place back then, part of it was to lay down this example of the severe consequences that come to those that disobey God and are guilty of the kinds of things that the children of Israel are guilty of. And then they were written down so that we can learn from them. We now have a record of that, that we can go back and not have to experience it firsthand. We can read about what God did with these others. And so now we can learn from them. But what is the lesson that we should be learning? We've already mentioned it. If you think you stand, if you think you know what you're doing, if you think you can expose yourself to all these temptations, to do all these sins, you better be very careful. You better take heed that you do not fall. You're probably on shaky ground if your knowledge is puffed up the way it is here. You need to take stock of take an honest look at where you really are and recognize the dangers you may be taking in. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. Is what the Corinthians experiencing with this pull maybe to go back to idolatry and to re-engage with society and partaking of meat sacrifice to idols or whatever the temptation is it unique to them? Is it something that is a pressure that they're, sometimes we tend to think that sometimes, that what I'm facing is something no one else has had to face. But Paul makes it clear is, you know, from the Israelite example, it's all happened before. These are common to man, the temptations that we find. And what are the two things that God is doing for us in this verse? That it can be encouraging.
Not tempting us beyond what we can handle.
He's not going to overwhelm us with temptations that we can't bear. He's not going to doom us to failure. But what does he provide?
Making a way of escape.
Way of escape. So for the Corinthians dealing with the temptation of idolatry and the immorality that comes with it, what's the way of escape? Run away. Flee from idolatry. Therefore, my beloved brethren, flee from idolatry. And then in the rest of these verses here, if you did your lesson or if you have opportunity to do your lesson, what does he compare this eating at an idol's temple with? Is there a parallel feast that we partake in as Christians?
The Lord's Supper.
The Lord's Supper, yeah. When we partake of the cup, we're sharing in the blood of Christ. There's our word in one of your questions. We're sharing the blood of Christ. When we break the bread, we're sharing in the body of Christ. And since we're all sharing of the one bread, that makes us all part of the one body. There's this communion here that takes place between us and each other and the Lord when we're partaking of the Lord's Supper. And that's the way it's meant to be. An Old Testament example, back when they made sacrifices in the Levitical priesthood, the worshiper would eat part of the sacrifice there as part of the worship. There was, again, that sharing that goes on there. So for an idol sacrifice, then, if you go in there to a pagan temple and they're sacrificing and you partake of that, what are you becoming? A sharer in this idol worship. And he calls it here, you're sharing in demons because they sacrifice to demons. Now, at first, that might be jarring. What might that suggest about an idol? Are you saying that that these idols are actually demons? That they're real things with powers and abilities, and is that what Paul's saying? Well, he says no. What do I mean? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything. This is what Marty was talking about. The knowledge they had in chapter 8 is there's no such thing as an idol. There's only one true God. Now he seems to be saying if you worship an idol, you're participating in this demonic thing. That sounds like there's something that's more than nothing. Is that what you're meaning, Paul? Is it no? That's not what I mean. There really isn't anything to an idol, or the meat that sacrifices is not intrinsically changed. But worshiping an idol, participating in a rite like that, is that a real thing? The children of Israel over and over and over again be punished for their idolatry? It provokes the Lord to jealousy. Over in James, he talks about the earthly wisdom that is, among other things, demonic. Paul in Ephesians talks about how our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. There are spiritual dimensions to the struggle that we have. And if we go worshiping idols, which side of that spiritual struggle are we siding with? Well, it's not with the Lord. It's not with God. It's on the demonic side of the equation there. So you can't go around partaking of the cup of demons, the table of demons, and expect to also fellowship with the Lord. They're incompatible with each other. We're not stronger than he, are we? Go back to the previous slide. If you get on the wrong side of God's wrath, do you think you can really stand up against that? The Israelites couldn't, and certainly we can't. So you need to stay away from that idolatry all you can. So having made that point and hopefully underscored to them the great personal risk that they were taking by thinking they could go into an idol's temple and eat these things, he then comes back to the meat question and tries to clarify a few things. These guiding principles here, all things are lawful, says that twice, but they're not always profitable. They don't always edify either yourself or others. There are things that may be technically lawful, but might have a spiritual erosion effect either on yourself or someone else. Seek the good. Don't seek your own rights or your own good, but that of your neighbor. That's the principle from chapter 8. And this is the chart that we looked at before. Anything that's sold, do you need to ask questions about it? Whether an idol sacrifice was involved with it? If it's in the market and it's not part of the worship, and it's not part of the ritual, it's just meat at that point. And you know that. This is the knowledge, right? You know that it's just meat. The earth is the Lord and all it contains. You can eat that. You don't need to ask questions about it. If you're in a situation, though, where, in this case, an unbeliever has invited you and there's this feast and they're eating meat, you need to ask about what the provenance of the meat is. Just eat it, right? Don't ask questions for it. But if someone says, by the way, we just had a ritual and we made this sacrifice and that's where this meat came from, then you need to stop. What are the two reasons why?
You don't be a stumbling block to others.
Yeah, so I think there are two possible dimensions to this, right? One is the one who informed you, right? So an unbeliever who might still think that there's something significant to this idol, and therefore it's special, and I'm serving it to you, and I'm telling you that it's special so that when you eat it, you can join with me in the worship of the idol. You can't do that with an unbeliever, right? Even though if you know that there's nothing to it, is that the message you know to send to an unbeliever? Is that idolatry is just fine? Definitely not. And then conscience sake, if there are those that have an objection to that who are already believers, then you need to be aware of their considerations. So that you might, if you go ahead and eat it confident in your knowledge that there's nothing to it, then you're back to the problem in chapter 8, perhaps, of influencing them to partake of it in a way that would cause them to violate their conscience. And this passage in 28-29, I think the guidance here is for primarily for the strong ones, right? Who know there's nothing wrong with this, right? There's nothing wrong with the meat. Meat's meat. Your actions, your conscience is, or your freedom is not judged by someone else's conscience. If you have the knowledge that the meat is acceptable to eat, you can eat it. If you don't, then I think even in these other scenarios, right, if you're still convinced that meat sacrificed to an idol is forbidden, then you need to be careful about the kind of meat that you're consuming. It's primarily the ones that have convinced themselves that it doesn't matter if it's been sacrificed or not, that they don't have to be so concerned unless it begins to influence other people around them. But again, in all of this, these are all scenarios where you're not directly participating in the idol worship that goes on in the temple. And then finally, these summary principles here, which applies not just to eating meat, right? It applies to whatever you do. You know, step one is you've got to do everything to the glory of God. If there's something that would offend God or provoke God to wrath or that God is, you need to stay away from those things. And idolatry certainly falls into that category. But then even among the realm of things that are not intrinsically good or bad, are there things that might cause offense to other groups of people that you want to build up and seek the benefit of? Yeah. If there's an action that would cause offense to anyone, you need to be willing to give that up, as Paul has done. Just as I also please Saint men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, so that they may be saved. That is the ultimate goal, both for myself and for others. Be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ. And that's the thread that runs through all this. All these actions of being willing to give up rights for others, that's what Christ did to the ultimate degree in giving his life to save us. Paul is just trying to mimic that in his own life, and we're called to do the same in the way we live our lives. All right. I've gone way over, but it's Wednesday night, so it's okay. I'm going to let Marty say what he needs to say for Wednesday, but maybe first, any final questions, comments about these chapters that we've taken so long to go through?
David, while you were talking through this, I was going back to at the beginning section, chapters 1-4 with divisions. There was this main foundation of man's wisdom versus God's wisdom. I see this overlaid through these chapters of reasoning. This is what challenges us personally. This is God's wisdom through this, because a lot of this wouldn't make sense. Why should I be judged by somebody else?
Right. Why should I have to take into consideration other people?
Especially a weaker person that's, you know, not as knowledgeable as me. I mean, exactly. Yeah, it's certainly counter our culture. Yeah.
Definitely.
It seems, Marty, that most of the times God is calling the stronger one to put up with the infirmities and the weaknesses of the weak as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said.
Yeah, I think so.
That's the way a family works, too, by the way.
True.
All right, David, if I can share screen, I think I'm going to boot you off if I do that. But I'll really, 30 seconds, I'll do this. So next Sunday, we're going to cover chapter 11, verses 2 through 16, which is the head covering text, okay? And everybody knows that there's a lot of different interpretations of that. What I think I want to do, and I'm almost fully convinced, unless some people start screaming after I explain it just now, I'm going to bring to the discussion three, maybe four interpretations, and here they are. And what I want to do is make this an exercise in hermeneutics. That is, like we talked about, I want everybody to practice shooting some jump shots between now and Sunday. And I'll get the lessons out, but they're basically, I would say, three positions. I might add the fourth one, which is the hair is the covering. One is a local custom, and it's not required today. A second one would be that men and women today should uncover or uncover their heads. By the way, the instructions to the men are just as numerous as to the women in the text. A third possibility is that it applies only when you're exercising spiritual, which would, in this case, and for this position, believes that prayer is miraculous. And then, so it only applies when you're doing a miracle, exercising the spiritual gift. And then the fourth position, I might put it in there, is hair. Now, here's what I want you to do. I'm going to ask you to take one of these positions and build the for and against chart like we talked about earlier. Read through the text. Each verse is going to either support it or not. There may be other information you can collect, and I'll put a little bit in there about local customs that helps or hurts the position. And I want us all to practice that. I'm going to ask you to pick a position that you don't necessarily hold. Okay? And the intent of this is an exercise in really looking at the text and trying impartially to see it in a different way, to understand other possible interpretations, and work through the way in which they might be supported or refuted. Is everybody okay with this? And we're going to break into groups. This is my plan at the moment. In groups, and you can volunteer to be in particular groups if you spent more time. And the groups will work on these positions and share what they have come up with. So I hope there's some peer pressure in that. You'll be able to, in your smaller group, show the preparation you've done again for each of these positions, okay? Is everybody okay with that? I don't know that you have a choice, but if you think that's terrible or it's going to cause divisions in the church or some other problem, let me know and I'll rethink it. But I think we ought to use this chapter, and it's an issue that's interesting enough and applicable enough to all of us that we should have all of us need to work our way through this individually and come to a firm conviction about what we believe, and then be consistent, practice that no matter how hard or how difficult or unpopular that might be. So I just want to practice doing that. So that's kind of going to take up most of the time Sunday, is taking a position in groups and working through the arguments for and against each one. And I'll get you some written material by tomorrow. Okay. That's my
but plan. Just one position, right? Marty just taking that's one right. position.
That's okay. right. And I'm again, I'm asking you to pick one that you don't agree with. Okay. And the intent isn't to kill it, right? It's to actually do your best job of defending it. Come up with all the arguments for it and then the arguments against it as well, right?
Yeah.
So, everybody okay with that? Clayton, you comment, suggestion? You're on mute.
Yeah, I was waiting for everyone in my room here to stop talking so I could come on mute. So the assumption that you make in requiring us to choose a position that we don't agree with is that we've at least studied this enough to have an opinion. So it might require a little bit of digging into it before we actually dig into it, huh?
Well, no, actually, this is a way to dig into it. So if you don't know, you know, which of these that you really think go ahead and pick one that you kind of favor or don't favor. I don't know. I'm not requiring you to have a belief before you go in, but I think a lot of people do. And I'm guessing most women, Christian women, have to have come to a conclusion about this, right? I mean, because they're doing something at the moment, and I hope they're not violating their conscience. So my guess is that most women would have felt a requirement to work their way through this and come to a personal conclusion. I actually think men should do that too. Individually, and there are some applications for potentially for men as well. So I hope this is fun, as opposed to whenever you study 1 Corinthians, everybody gets nervous when they get to chapter 11. I'm not going to tell you the answer. So, you know, you're going to be disappointed if you're waiting to hear the Embry-Hill's position on this or Marty's position. I want us to use it to learn to study, because this is the way God wants us to be. Interested in working it out for ourselves, not waiting for the church or some pseudo scholar to tell us what we're supposed to believe, right? Everybody, I hope I've made that point. Okay? I took longer than I intended, but anyway.
It's only 15 verses, so how hard can it be?
How hard can that be?
Well, thank you all for your participation tonight, your attention, and letting us go over this will be a challenge on Sunday because we have a hard cutoff. It's going to be tough for Marty, so be thinking of him as he prepares for.
Yeah, if we do enough work beforehand, we'll be quick on Sunday, right?
That's right. That's right.
And plus, I'm going to cheat, so just so you know.